From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, architecture critic Tom Bamberger responds to last week's changes in the design for the planned addition to the Milwaukee Art Museum. Then auto contributor Mark Savage has some advice for car makers dealing with a potential recall notice.
I've already heard people talking, you know, around the water cooler, as they say in the office, saying, you know, this is as close to corporate moral bankruptcy as they've seen if you're going to not even take responsibility for it at this point.
And with the opening of a Mequon store, Outpost Natural Foods looks back and ahead at its mission.
We have people that, you know, that are looking for inexpensive way to eat better. We try to cater to our owners that are really passionate about organics. So we try to offer a wide selection of that. And then we have owners that are really passionate about local.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. A week ago, we broke the news that the Milwaukee Art Museum had revised its plans for a new addition. The newest design was the work of architect Jim Shields, who had made news about a month earlier when he left the project. A design was released at that point, and it attracted a great deal of criticism, most significantly from Tom Bamberger, critic at the website Urban Milwaukee. Well, speaking last week on Lake Effect, Shields described what's changed from the much maligned plans to their current incarnation.
Well, I think one thing that we've been working on is the design that was released in April. It had one area where the upper story cantilevered out. But one of the things that we've worked on now is both on the north, east, and south to have this building cantilever out over the lakefront. And that's where the building overhangs the lake without any means of visible means of support. Columns are retreated into the building, and the upper building is protruding out. And I think this lends a sort of dynamic floating quality, and it also allows public space to sort of move through and under the building. And it's a kind of embracing gesture. It's also a notion that perhaps wave action has acted on this building to carve out or remove that first floor. And then that first floor has become all glass public space. That's something that didn't happen. There was some solid wall, quite a bit of it in that earlier design. Now essentially the entire first floor is public space, open, transparent, so someone can go in, have a cup of coffee, and see Lake Michigan on a sub-zero day, which looks really cool, by the way. But most Milwaukeeans don't have a chance to see that. And now they would, sort of like a living room for the city. And I think these changes have really been positive.
Is this version pretty final? I mean, I know things aren't final until they're built, pretty much, but are we looking at what seems to be pretty solid?
I think so. We have quite a few decisions to make, but not ones that'll substantially alter the image of the building. For example, we're talking about cladding this building in metal, a natural metal that would patina. So we've been looking, for example, at two metals that have a somewhat similar appearance, both a dark zinc, and we've been looking at a naturally weathered copper. And we're excited about these because, unlike most materials, these actually develop a patina. For example, the sarin and the kaolin out of concrete, they actually develop a weathered patina. It's not supposed to be super clean. There's some evidence of the passage of time and of age.
That's Jim Shields, principal at HGA Architects, speaking on Lake Effect last week and describing the changes to the design for the Milwaukee Art Museum's planned addition. Well, critic Tom Bamberger joins me now to share his thoughts on the new design. Tom, welcome back to the show. And it sounds like you like the new design a lot more.
Yeah, I like it better than the two previous designs. Now, recall that the first design was done by Jim Shields, and it was kind of an atmospheric, a diaphanous glass cloud.
And kind of white, I remember,
yes,
too.
And yeah. The idea there was that, you know, you have these two overbearing or large figures, Sarin and Calatrava, and you wanted this to sort of blend in. I like it better than that design, but, you know, normally I don't review renderings because I just don't really believe them. But what happened was, what alarmed me was that then apparently Shields, and as he said on your program, they had some kind of a a dispute or whatever, and he was off the project. And then the museum kind of came up with their own design, and that one was horrible, unbelievably bad, and that's why I wrote the article. Now, the present design, Shields came back on the project, and what's so great is this design, it takes the building in another direction and really improves on the first design. Anybody, a monkey, could improve on the second design. I mean, that wasn't done by a professional architect. It was sort of done the way, the way buildings are developed out, in the suburbs. You kind of figure out where everything goes. You build a big closet for all your stuff, and then you say, oh, it has to look like something, and you slap something on it. So let's just forget the second design for a second, even though that was why I wrote the article. Which was, by the way, I think the headline was something like, you can't build this building, don't do it. I mean, an architect or critic, I would never imagine I would have to do that. That is, to me, that is beyond my pay grade, generally speaking. But in any case, so they didn't, they got rid of the second design. And the third design, which is the second design by Shields, is a really great advance over the first.
Do you think that it solves or answers all the criticisms that you had and addresses what you feel the any building there should be doing on that site?
Well, first of all, we remember we're just talking about the outside of the building now. The inside's kind of important. That's another question. And I wrote the article about the second design that was like a non-design. But what this does, I think the genius of it, is that, I mean, the big design element that he did that was fantastic is he figured out how to sort of wrap the building around the Kaler stub. Now, wrapping the building around the stub allowed him to put the stairways, tuck them in so they're not tacked on the side of the building as a previous Shields design. But it also slims out the profile of the building. You know, the problem always was you have this big, huge concrete rectangle that was sort of filled in by when I was working at the museum. It was filled in for 15 more works of art. They filled it in not realizing that they were losing something really important, more important than the 15 works of art. So anyways, this design, unlike the previous one that was like shy, this one is bold. And what I learned looking at it, it sort of dawned on me is, first of all, the wraparound slims the building and kind of streamlines it a little bit. That's a good thing. It changes the rectangle and the proportions. But the other good thing is that Shields' original approach was wrong. And you can't build a shy building on this site. It has to assert itself. And it actually goes back to a lot of the ideas of the original Kaler design that was bastardized or filled in by when the College Travel was built.
And somebody put a comment on your article online, too, that this new design seems to echo the Saarinen so much better.
Well, I'm not a – I think echoes, by and large, are a bad thing in architecture. Harmonies are not so great either. But I think what he was saying, what was interesting, is Shields left some interesting negative spaces on this, and it's cantilevered out like the Saarinen. It's rectilinear like the Saarinen. And I think he's using the same language as a Saarinen in a very adept way. Architects develop their own languages. And the Saarinen building, right at the end of his life, when he did that building and then he went and did the famous TWA terminal that's in all the movies, the TWA terminal was his curvy thing. The Saarinen building in Milwaukee is a fantastic articulation of his rectilinear ideas. Squares and rectangles and such. So, yeah, I think the building does that, but I think it also stands on its own.
I like, and one of the things I said to Jim Shields when he was sitting in that chair was that I like the transparency of it. I like the fact that you can now, when you're coming from the north down the walkway,
right. You
can see through it and you can see the Calatrava, you can see other things, and it feels both planted there but also lighter.
Well, that was the original idea. You have to remember what happened here. There's a little bit of mission creep. The original idea was to fix the east entrance. Calatrava was a genius. He got the Milwaukee Art Museum, which didn't really have a face to the city, created a face, a bridge, all these great things, but they just forgot about the lake. So the original proposal was really a correction of the building to open it up and then fix all the things that had to be fixed inside the building. But there was an inevitable conflict between, you know, curators there, and I was a curator, and directors. It's impossible to avoid. They're these PhD nerds, and they just want to show more work of art. So after Shields left the project, what they did is they lost the transparency. They made it into gallery space. That's, you know, it's increased the size of the closets and blocked off the building from the lake. So they ended up with more gallery space and an entrance, but not an entrance that Shields envisioned or Kaler, and that is an entrance where you walk in and you still you go from the lake, this grand scene, and that sort of follows you in there, and then you can also have an art experience. The museum's version of it was basically a table and a coat rack and, you know, stairs upstairs.
So from your perspective, and you've lived and worked here a long time, and I'm curious because I'm relatively new here. I haven't even been here a decade yet.
A decade. I used to think a decade was a long time.
It was a long time. I know as we get older, Tom. But what has this whole process taught us? Because this started out as, oh, we're going to make an addition. This is great. You know, the initial design was wonderful. Then we had the issues. We had the problems. A building no one liked. Now we have a building that people do like. It has been approved for construction by the city. What did we learn from all of this?
That is a good question. I think we learned simply that architecture matters, that architects matter. And you have to understand that Milwaukee is a very difficult town for architects. Very few buildings up until the last 15 years were even built by architects. And that there's a creative process, a partnership that exists between the client and the architect. And you need both. So what happened here was you start out with a good architect. And, of course, good architects have to educate their clients. And they had a problem. You need a good client and a good architect. They start out with and optimistically with both. Then they ended up having a little lapse in the relationship. And frankly, the art museum was an unforgivably bad client to not know how to work with another artist, to sort of push them or to think that they're just going to do it without professional help. I think we learned that architecture matters, and all you have to do is go online and look at the second design, and you'll see that's very much like most of the buildings in America that were built in the 90s and the 80s. All those big buildings you drive by when you go around Chicago, that's the way they're built without an architect. So that's the first thing, is that architecture matters. The other thing, this is a conflict really between what I describe as floor space and headspace, and there's a revolution that's happening, I think, in museums. And what that basically is that curators and the standard view is, yes, you just want more floor space. If you can do an addition and show more art, that everybody benefits. It's like more money. But that's not the way the brain works. You know, museum fatigue was discovered in the early part of this century, and art museums have done nothing the Harley Museum, all these other museums have been influenced by figuring out a way, the cognitive way to bridge the gap between a human being and a work of art. I think that's the job of a museum, not to tell them everything you know about the history of art, is to create a situation, a cognitive situation, where people can appreciate art.
And so do you think that this building is going to allow that? I mean, well, I know we haven't seen the inside yet.
That's a really good question. Now, here's something that's pretty interesting. When I was at the museum, that exact same building, they had these consultants come in from Chicago. We worked with them. All the curators worked with them, and they came up with a plan, which is very similar to, the plan for the inside that Jim Shields wanted. And that is essentially – Saarinen actually has two holes in his building for an addition. And you make those two holes into avenues. So you have a structure like a street. So when you're in the museum, you kind of know where you are. Well, what happened when Russell Bowman was there, And it's the same thing that's, I think, probably going to happen now, is they only ended up with one avenue because the other avenue would mean you can't show 10 other paintings. So when you go to museums and you get lost and it's a rabbit warren rather than a kind of a stable place where you know where you are and you can navigate it. So that would be important to carry Jim Shields' ideas or just good ideas about the way in which we really actually interact with art. But I'm afraid that they're going to lapse in the insides and say, lost the gallery space from the extension of the building. Now they're going to try to cram more art in, which will make the avenues
tighter
or get rid of them, and it'll just become a maze.
So that is a fear that you have, that we won't necessarily get a better art experience in the new building.
No one ever, as I say in my article, no one ever leaves a museum and says, God, I wish there was more pictures on the wall. It's never happened. Now, they might say, I wish there was more good pictures on the wall. But there are more pictures on the wall than anybody can possibly digest as it is. So I think the job of the museum, and that's why opening up the lake is a great thing. It's an obvious thing. It's a beautiful thoroughfare. And also, what the problem is the reason they needed that entrance is the Calatrava building, as wonderful as it is, put the collection of the whole museum more than a football field away in a dark hole. So to have the experience of just walking in rather than having to go through all the Calatrava swirls and, you know, it's a very narcissistic building. It's all about Calatrava. People don't build museums like that anymore. But to be able to enter this other way changes the narrative with the way in which you enter and encounter the arts. So that was the original. The problem is that the Calatrava, the museum never had a real opening, a real entrance. They built this huge entrance, which actually sort of upstaged the collection. So that was one of the basic ideas, one of the great ideas behind the lake level entrance.
So what do you think is next? And what would you like to see happen? Shovel in the dirt is this fall, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm delighted. I mean, I never thought I'd just write an article and say this building can't be built, and then a couple days later they come in and say, hey, we got a new design. Now, that's not what – I mean, that was a surprise, I guess, to you, but that would also have been a surprise to the board. You know, the board approved this design. I don't know what they were thinking. After my article, there were memos to the board explaining that people like me or anybody, the commenters on Mary Louise's site or Urban Milwaukee, was just dismissed as chatter. But so I'm delighted about that hunk of it. And, you know, the rest of it can be changed. They're going to put up a building that's a good building that expresses the values that are contained in the other two buildings. So that's all I could really hope for. So this is sort of like, Christmas for a critic, or maybe Hanukkah in my case.
Yeah, Hanukkah in May.
Hanukkah in May, yes.
I like it. It could be a good band name, Hanukkah in May. Well, Tom Bamberger, as always, a pleasure to have you on the show, and thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's fun.
Tom Bamberger is former curator of photography at the Milwaukee Art Museum. His critique of the plans for the museum's new addition is online at urbanmilwaukee.com. You can also hear our interview with Art Museum Director Dan Keegan and architect Jim Shields at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. It's all about recalls next, and we're talking about car recalls. That conversation with Mark Savage in just a moment when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Automotive recalls are fairly common, and they usually require a straightforward fix. However, not all car companies handle them in a way that endears them to consumers. Just ask GM. The recent recall over a faulty ignition switch that caused vehicles to shut down while in motion was handled badly, and a lawsuit has been brought against the company. Lake Effect's regular auto contributor Mark Savage joins Dan Harmon in the studio and says not all recalls are because of faulty mechanics or electrics.
Well, a lot of the big major car manufacturers have had a lot of recalls, but there was one funny one, I think, of late, which, you know, maybe not funny if it's your car still, but Mazda recalled about 42,000 of their cars. I think they were mostly Mazda 6s because yellow sack spiders somehow got into the evaporator canister and were building spider webs in there and clogging those up. So they did have a recall on that, and they've had this happen now twice to them. So you're wondering what is going on in the factory that makes these vent lines and canisters and so forth. You know, what maybe they need to do some bug spray in there or something.
Did the spiders get in at the factory, or is this just something that they noticed that the spiders were more able to get into the car because of a design flaw or something?
I don't know that they've actually proven where or how they got in there, but this has happened to them twice for at least a fair amount of vehicles. So they may be ready to redesign that piece.
But they were on top of it, though.
They were on top of it.
And they didn't.
And that's the lesson, I think, for recalls.
Is to not spin a web of deceit.
Do not spin a web of deceit, but instead come clean as quickly as you find out there's a problem and issue your recall as quickly as you possibly can.
Unlike GM. Let's just jump right into GM. Like, what did they do wrong? Well, first of all, what was the recall? And then maybe we can talk about how they handled it.
They've had 6 recalls in the last month or so, and that's about 4.25 million vehicles that they've recalled in. And it's not unusual for anybody, you know, any of the car makers to have a recall that could affect a million vehicles, because if it's on a popular model and it's been a couple of years that there's a problem, then and we all know that many recalls are minor things. Mm-hmm. Well, this one is their ignition switch not working properly, and apparently you can turn off your engine and the airbags are off and you don't know that this is happening. You can – like the key actually can fall out or jiggle loose, and it basically turns off the ignition. And with that, sometimes your steering would go – you know, if you have power steering, that could be a problem. And that the airbags won't work. According to media reports, this has led to 13 deaths. And this has been going on apparently for years, because the cars that they recalled go back many, many model years. And so – the mistake apparently was that they knew about it a long time ago and they did not do any recalls. And obviously it's not just that this is an inconvenience or it's a problem and they needed to fix it, but it was a safety hazard. That really was a safety hazard and apparently has led to a number of deaths, which I've got a feeling they're going to be paying for many years to come.
So the ignition would be – it would shut off while one was driving.
While you were
disabling
driving
the car. All the, like,
right.
Okay, so you couldn't drive anymore and they wouldn't be protected if you did crash.
Right, and one of the things that they've suggested is, you know, try to avoid bumpy streets, because that it could cause your key to not register in the ignition and therefore you'd turn off your car. Easier said than done in most, at least, northern climate cities.
Right, and then take off, you know, the 10,000 things you have attached to your keychain.
Yes, okay. That's another one of the warnings is that you should be just using the single key. I guess the good news is that more and more cars now have the push button start, so maybe that will be less of a problem with those. But even so, if you've got a GM car with a key and, you know, go online and check it out and make sure you know whether your car is impacted by this, because it is a serious, you know, recall.
All right. So as regarding how they handled it, what should they have done?
Well,
what did they do wrong?
Well, I think any time that you know that there's a problem, you need to act as quickly as possible and, you know, tell people about it as quickly as possible, especially if it's a safety concern. It's one thing maybe if your, you know, taillight lens is falling off or something that has some impact, but it's not, you know, devastating. And from what I have read, this is a small fix. They could fix this, I believe it was for 57 cents. and someone made the conscious decision not to fix it, first of all, which I think, like I say, they're going to be in the courts for some time dealing with that. But then you've now ruined your reputation, which I think it's particularly bad timing for GM because they've got a lot of nice cars out and they've redesigned a lot of their lineups. And I would say for the last 2 to 3 years maybe, they've been on a pretty good roll and looking like they've bounced back. And obviously they went through the, you know, the government financed by bankruptcy that they were allowed, and you know they were back on their feet and looking great, and then all of a sudden this hits them, and apparently this has been, like I say, can be attributed back several generations of leadership there anyway.
Seems like this happens every 5 or 10 years. I mean, Toyota just had the lawsuit was settled, or the court case was settled. I'm not sure which one it is, and then we can go back to sudden acceleration in Audis and then the Pinto. I mean. Are they not learning from these experiences?
Well, I think the smarter companies learn from it, and they immediately, you know, like say, come clean, if that's the, you know, right terminology, but admit it that there's a problem. But some apparently have not, or the bureaucracy that they have created for their company does not allow this to get to the right people to make the right decisions anyway, quickly enough. And I got to say, I read the paper just recently that GM's now arguing that this was the old GM that did this before the bankruptcy and that they should not be held accountable legally for this. I feel like they're adding bad PR on top of bad PR, and I've already heard people talking to, you know, around the water cooler, as they say, in the office, saying, you know, this is as close to corporate moral bankruptcy as they've seen if you're going to not even take responsibility for it at this point.
Wow. Well, there are high hopes for the new CEO of GM, first woman CEO. How has her performance been? Has she owned up? I mean, is this all below her, the people that are saying these things, or is she part of that, do you think?
Well, I haven't heard of anything saying that she was directly involved with making the decision. She sadly, this broke on her watch maybe, what, a month into her reign as CEO. Mm-hmm. I think she has looked fairly good at the testimony in front of Congress and so forth, and they've admitted they have a problem. I guess that, as in many things, that's your first step.
All right.
But I think the fact that now that you're allowing the lawyers to take over and say, wait a minute, we aren't responsible for this. These were people long before our time and a different company altogether. Well, you know, as they say, that doesn't pass the smell test.
Yeah. That's not a very consumer-friendly way of looking at it.
And not a very consumer-friendly way, especially when deaths are involved.
Yeah. Right. All right. So where is it at now? Is it still – are we still in the midst of – working this out?
Well, I think yes. I mean, you know, there is the recall. They've admitted they have a problem. There is a fix for the problem. That's all good. So you can get your car fixed. But I think, like I say, the ramifications of this is, you know, this will be in the courts, and for the next 8 or 10 years, we'll be hearing occasionally something like this coming out, and how many millions or billions of dollars this is going to cost them. I have no idea, but it's going to be a lot of money, and well, there go the price of your car is going to go up too, I guess,
yeah,
along the
yeah.
way. That's,
and some
that's
image,
how that gets dealt with.
Image control or damage control along
and
top
damage
of that.
Control, right. And, you know, and I also just read today that Toyota is still number one and GM number two in the car world. And here both of them have had horrible recall-type experiences. And Toyota's, you know, big problem is that recently they were found guilty of lying about their sudden acceleration problems. And they had to pay out $1.2 billion for that. I think that's a pretty good chunk of change to get people's attention. But again, you know, this watch for your price of your car to go up a little bit.
Well, what lessons are there to be learned from Toyota? I mean, if they're still number one and two, then there is no damage to repair. If they can just keep going and they can be number one and two, then what is there to repair?
Well, you're right. And in that regard, that it hasn't had an impact currently, and Toyota didn't take a big sales hit along the way with the problems that they've had. So it does make you wonder. I mean, obviously it makes some buyers suspicious and some buyers more hesitant, but it hasn't hurt them big enough time to, I guess, change their behavior at this point, other than I think most of the car companies have proven that they are readily will admit that there's a problem when the time comes. And These two are the kind of the exception to the rule, but they're large and they affect a large number of vehicles and they affect a large number of people, and both are serious. So, you know, other people have had recalls and they have them and the cars get fixed. I think, you know, I used to own a Mazda and it had one recall on it, and, you know, you took it in, the people fixed it and you went away and everything was fine. But that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah. Are these not factored into the cost of doing business, that this is something that's likely going to happen?
Right. And especially with all the electronics we have in cars these days, and it doesn't take much for an electronic gremlin to jump out and bite people. And, you know, they test and test and test. But especially those of us in more extreme climates and with aging infrastructures that beat the heck out of your cars and bounce things around, that maybe something comes disconnected, or, you know, you have a little wiring glitch or something rubs against something and it breaks a wire. So I think this will be commonplace as far as having recalls, but we hope that people will learn from these kind of past mistakes and, you know, come clean sooner and offer to fix quicker.
And just to be fair to manufacturers, I mean, it does take a little while for them to realize something is recallable. I mean, there has to be kind of a repair pattern established, and that it is something that actually is worthy of a recall.
Right. It's not like let's say you had a new model year 2014 car and now you've sold 50,000 of them already, but it's only been 6 months. It may take that 6 months or 8 months or a year for you, say, to establish that kind of repair pattern, or even where dealers are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, I've had three of these in my own dealership, and then they start alerting people. So it does take a little while, and you just hope that if it takes very long, it's not a serious problem that you're dealing with.
All right. And we mentioned you mentioned earlier Ford. What has been their recall issue? Do they handle it well?
Well, theirs is a smaller one. I think it was about 435,000 Ford Escapes and older model years, like 2001 to 2004, I believe. And it was a faulty seat problem and then a rusty frame member problem. So they have a new strut that they're putting in, or a support to help shore up the frame. Luckily, apparently, there have not been any serious accidents caused by this and no deaths, you know, blamed but for this. So that one appears to be here, obviously, many years later, but the rust being a problem, the rust usually doesn't happen overnight. So that took a while. The faulty seat, you kind of wonder why somebody didn't figure that out a little quicker. But at least they have, you know, said, here's the problem. We have a fix. Come and get your car fixed. And, you know, Nissan has had some too. Chrysler's had some with their Jeep Grand Cherokee and Durango lately. That was a brake default, problem. And so they are working on that. And the airbags were the problem with the Nissans. They got like 1 million vehicles. But again, so far, I haven't read anything, and it says that there was a death involved, but these are problems that they've found and they're correcting them.
Thank you, Mark, for coming in.
No problem. Thanks.
Lake Effect contributor Mark Savage is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's auto writer. He's also associate publisher for four magazines at Waukesha's Kalmbach Publishing, American Snowmobiler, Classic Toy Trains, Fine Scale Modeler, and Scale Auto Magazine. Savage spoke with Dan Harmon. The state of mortification in which first-generation Americans often find themselves. A Lake Effect essayist shares her story when we return with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. For some who grow up raised by people from a different country, it can be an experience that is hairbreadth away from being indescribable. It can also provide many moments of red-faced, horrific distress. Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas counts herself among that group.
Growing up raised by those who are in denial about the length of their stay in this new country moves from a typical life of a few childhood moments that are of survivable embarrassment to instruction manual of living in this country, please end now. There were many times in my youth that the eternal loop playing in my head was, The only way I'm ever going to make it out of here with one personality is to start to write some of this down and see if it makes more sense on paper. I am a first-generation American, the first one born here. Everyone else in my family that came before me knows nothing about living in the United States. My childhood experiences are of grinding meat manually with a meat grinder so that my aunts and uncles can fill sausages with homemade casings to give as gifts. Have you ever been so embarrassed that your face actually burns from mortification? I grew up in a chronic state of mortification. My Colombian grandmother, my abuela, was my primary caregiver. We had a beautiful relationship. If the Coexist t-shirt was available back then, we would have been wearing them. She came to America to help my mother, a recent widow with six children. But my grandmother never had plans to permanently remain in this country. I knew this because she kept her suitcase at the bottom of the bed, packed and ready to head back to South America at the first drop of the word vamonos. But until then, with her limited English, she needed me to do her interpreting for her. People who arrive in this country with the hope and dream of remaining here forever try their hardest to assimilate. Those who fall asleep with their suitcase at the foot of their bed every night pretty much have no intention in their lifetime of ever giving up the ways from the old country. Why should they? In their mind, they're only visiting until the civil unrest in their country dies down. My grandmother's favorite place to pretend as if she had no idea she was in America was in our neighborhood grocery store. There were no Mega Mart Super Savers in the late 60s, and the neighborhood grocery store was sure to be filled with all the children from my school when I would be there with my abuela. Lucky me, a chance to show off my ethnic roots as my grandmother would walk over to produce, pick up avocados in her hand, tisk at their diminutive size and pale green skin, and then tell me in Spanish, "I will offer them $1 for five. They are the size of pebbles." She'd walk the five fruit up to the register with $1 in her hand. The cashier would ring up our five items and give us the total. "Two for a dollar. You want to get one more?" she'd suggest, which my abuela heard as, "Let's bargain. What say you to 4 pesos for 5 avocados? I stood next to my grandmother in the checkout lane as she'd prepare her counter offer, my cheeks on fire, while Tommy Boyer, only the cutest boy in second grade, stood behind us. "No," my grandmother would respond firmly. Then turning to me, she'd say in Spanish, "Tell that robber I will give her 1 peso and no more. Look how green they are. No." I would have all the intentions of obeying. I wanted to translate for my grandmother, but then I'd hear my voice grow distant as I entered the 4 stages of mortification. Stage 1, tingling and numbness of extremities and scalp. Stage 2, spotted, dotty vision. Stage 3, temporary paralysis of lower limbs. Stage 4, fiery crash of my conscience. I couldn't say it. I would begin to stammer and spit and jumble my words into Spanglish. I would lie. "No, abuela, no. She says you can't bargain. You have to pay what she says." "¿Qué? What? Whoever heard of paying what somebody asks? This country may be free, but it costs plenty." With a sigh, my grandmother would resign herself to these United States. She'd click open her small black leather coin purse and pluck down her 3 single bills for 5 pebbly, unripe avocados. With our purchases bagged, I would pull my grandmother away from Tommy Boyer and his mother as fast as I could. But believe me, he didn't miss a beat of her outdoor South American market performance. I was teased mercilessly on the playground the next day. I didn't ignore the laughter at my expense during recess, but I didn't laugh along with them either. I didn't try to run away. I couldn't run away. This was the country we had run to. What magic answer of coping skills would I have given myself as a young girl in the middle of chronic mortification? Only this. One day, some of your most unsurvivable moments will turn you into a storyteller with a limitless bank of golden moments to share. But first, you'll have to give it a good 30 years of distance before your left eye twitch calms down to a socially acceptable rate.
Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas is a contributing author of the Her Stories Project, as well as other anthologies. She's also a Milwaukee Grand Slam storytelling champion for The Moth and producer of the Listen to Your Mother show in Milwaukee. She lives with her family in Cedarburg. Outpost opens its newest outpost, what the Mequon store means for a homegrown Milwaukee institution. So stay tuned for more of Lake Effect. It comes your way right after this on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have your company this morning. Outpost Natural Foods has come a long way since it took root in 1970. That's when a group of Milwaukee residents pooled their resources to purchase food they considered wholesome and whole. The new store was called the East Kane Street Food Co-op. Shares sold for $2.50, and volunteers staffed the store. It later changed its name to Outpost. Now, several decades later, the store has grown to include branches around the metro area and even has market cafes in a downtown Milwaukee hospital and a YMCA in Brown Deer. And yesterday, Outpost celebrated the opening of its fourth store, this one in Mequon. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz visited as the shelves were being stocked and the finishing applied to learn about the co-op's big-picture vision of sustainability.
Are still cleaning up and planting trees outside as I make my way inside the store to meet Zach Heppner.
Heppner is Outpost's local buyer. He's not the first person I find in the store's loading dock. Store receiver Ryan Miracle and manager Tom Knipple are admiring their new gigantic green baler.
So what do you bale?
Cardboard.
So you mean after the stuff comes in, then you...
Well, after we put it on the shelf, then we bale the cardboard.
Yep. And then? What happens?
They're recycled. They're picked up.
Who picks them up, do you know?
I don't know the name of the place.
Newness is in the air. Inside the store, where everything seems to gleam, Luis Santiago is giving cafe tables another once-over. He's brand new to the Outpost team and seems excited to join the kitchen staff.
It's a brand new job for me.
How did you find out about it?
Oh, I got friends working in the company.
So you've done some cooking before?
Oh, not really. It's the first time.
So it's a brand new career.
Yes.
So what do you think your cooking specialty will become when you really get rolling?
I like the sandwiches, the salads. It's nice.
Still no Zach Heppner in sight, but Outpost Sustainability Manager Jessie Servi strolls in my direction. She's eager to talk about the stormwater and energy-saving strategies of the new Mequon structure.
Energy is one of our largest consumers as a retailer, and so in this store we had the opportunity to buy the most state-of-the-art energy-efficient equipment for the store. There's LED lights pretty much everywhere, except for some of the overheads in the parking lot as well. When it comes to water management, we were really able to capture all of our rainwater on site and manage it here.
That includes a massive rain garden system along the south and west sides. A Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District grant helped finance the project, and another system that funnels rain from the rooftop.
Storing them into underground cisterns, and that water will be used for the landscaping. Another cool thing that we do at some of the stores, and in this one as well, is the heat from the refrigeration system is reclaimed and used to heat water. Yeah, so that's another way we're able to save on energy. We also are using the reverse osmosis wastewater.
Serbi moves to the store entrance, where customers can fill up jugs of filtered drinking water. That's another area the store saves and recycles water. Serbi says for every gallon customers tap,
there's a gallon or more of wastewater.
And so why is that? I don't get it.
Because they're filtering it. So they're filtering out, it's a reverse osmosis filtration system.
All right. So now where does that water go?
So now the water gets pumped to a holding tank that's behind this wall that we can't actually see, but it's above the bathrooms. Yeah. Actually, if we go around the corner, I can. Okay. There is a little
access.
So it's not 100% of that water that gets put into the toilets because it does have a high mineral content. And so we do add
some city water
to mix with that to put into the toilet.
She says sustainability goes beyond capturing and flushing water. It includes, when possible, repurposing. The store footprint stands on what was once a house and barn. Those buildings were carefully deconstructed to pull out as much usable materials and artifacts as possible. Ladders found in the barn serve as display racks. Servi says several trees had to be removed from the lot to make way for the store, so she looked for ways to make up for that loss. She points to the store's north wall, paneled in various types and shades of wood.
So that wall, for example, that you see on the far corner is all urban wood. Trees that come down across the city from things like the Emerald Ash Borer, instead of going to wood chip, the city of Milwaukee has been directing them to a mill, and hopefully that wood goes to a higher use, and this is an example of that.
Jessie Servi not only approaches her job with a master's in business in hand, she's also a certified permaculture designer, so says she's super keen on what's planted outside the store, besides the permeable pavement and massive rain garden.
There's 5 pear trees out on the west side of the building that we'll be able to pick from and use in our cafe. We're going to have a kitchen garden that's going to be managed by our staff, where we're going to be growing herbs and vegetables for the cafe. I have a whole raspberry line, about 60 feet of raspberries.
Outpost's vision is to source an ever-increasing amount from local and regional producers. Servi says that goal comes with a laundry list of criteria.
The factors include organic, we look at the nutritional content, the environmental impact, the type of additive or natural preservative. There are a whole list of preservatives that we won't allow in the store and that we've had to pull, even though customers like it, because they say, nope, this has this product and we don't believe that's safe. So we'll pull it off the shelf.
It's the job of Zach Heppner, yes, the fellow I've been waiting for, to seek out local while balancing that weighty list. Heppner is
a local purchasing specialist. I'm trying to find local and regional products for all the stores.
Heppner has his job cut out for him. Outpost's goal is to source 75% of its total sales locally, or at least regionally, by the year 2022. Right now, the business has achieved 29%.
So, Zach, where do you see the greatest potential right now of upping that percentage?
It's a constant struggle, but I'll give you a great example. We just recently brought in a Greek yogurt called Odyssey Yogurt out of Monroe, Wisconsin. And it's less expensive and I think better tasting and higher quality than some of the national brand Greek yogurts. And we're selling what I would call a very large volume for having just brought it on. I think we sold somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,500 units of their yogurt in the month of April. And we only brought it on in the month of April. This is a situation where an established creamery, Klondike Creamery, built a brand new Greek yogurt facility in September of 2013 to kind of capitalize on that trend. And I think it's only going to grow. Another interesting one to point out is, and it sometimes goes in the opposite direction, we actually had less local sales in bread in 2013 than we did in 2012. And I think that, I would have to go back and verify all my numbers, but I think that it was kind of the gluten-free trend. And national brands like Udi's doing a really, really good job of having a good-tasting, inexpensive, gluten-free bread available. And I think that our customers have really responded to that and maybe moved away from some of the local vendors that we sell.
Heppner says it's his job to balance the diverse interests of the co-op's many members.
We have, like, I think, over 18,000 owners for sure, if not close to 18,500. And we have customers that are shopping for, that are just transitioning into natural foods. So they're looking for, they're a little more price sensitive, or we have people that, you know, that are looking for an inexpensive way to eat better. We try to cater to our owners that are really passionate about organics. So we try to offer a wide selection of that. And then we have owners that are really passionate about local. And we have owners that are passionate about all of those things. So we try to offer as broad a range of products as possible.
Right now, one of the products that's on its way up is a libation served on tap in the store's cafe called kombucha.
Kombucha is a fermented green and or black tea. And then basically you ferment it, and it's like a living digestive drink. So when you're drinking it, it has they call it a SCOBY or a mother. It has live bacteria in it. And people drink it for all sorts of reasons. They drink it for vitality, digestive aid. But this is a local kombucha vendor, Tapawat Kombucha, and they're out of Sister Bay. So, yeah, they're great. They were amazing partners in working with us and getting this program implemented. Being distributed by a local Wisconsin distributor and brought to our stores, we can get that 3 days a week, and we get their kegs of kombucha. It's great. It cuts down on bottle waste. It's a unique product. It tastes better. It ages. It has a great character. Yeah, it's really, really cool.
I'm going to try it. Okay.
As I sample the black raspberry, Heppner shares his passion for the product.
I'm safe in saying that we're the first grocery store in Wisconsin to offer kombucha on tap.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Zach Heppner is local purchasing specialist for Outpost Natural Foods. Jesse Servi is its sustainability manager. They talked with WUWM's Susan Bentz at the just-opened Mequon branch of the Outpost Natural Foods Co-op. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.